weigh the benefits, if the benefits outweigh some of the problems that were discussed today. I cannot do that, but I am asking for this committee to consider what he said, because he really, I thought, hit some points that were so important. He said, Rosanna, remember when you are dealing with legislation, we must always look at how it will benefit all the people of the state. And that's what I just wanted to share with you today. Yesterday, my son and his friend were stopped. They are not of color. They are teenagers in a beat-up Volkswagen. They were rushing out of an apartment house, jumping into their car. And the security officer stopped them and said, "You're in an awful hurry. What are you doing?" Well, what they were doing is they worked there in the kitchens, and they were in a hurry to get home and get off the job. But they were stopped, and so that can happen to any of us. I think the circumstances warranted it, because running out of an apartment complex, jumping in a car and taking off could mean that there might be something going on that should be looked into.
Thank you, Rosanna. We will, Jim, you have a question.
Well, I guess I just have to say, though, is that I understand what that gentleman is saying, but at the same time, because you're black, you don't want to have a presumption that you're doing something wrong and that you are a criminal because there are black people in your community that are doing bad things. And I think a white person feels that way too. But the thing is, it seems easier with black people to make an assumption that somehow more of us than normal are involved in this evil with things. And I mean, people still want the distinction to be made. And that's all like anyone else. And that would be my only response to it. And I would say this: I'm not ready to sacrifice my rights simply because if someone my color is doing something, I'm still an individual. And it doesn't mean that because I happen to be the same color as somebody else is doing something, that I'm going to say it's okay to stop and harass me any more than I would want it done to anybody else.
Senator Hill, I couldn't agree with you more, and I don't think this law gives anyone permission to stop and harass anyone.
We're in the business of sending messages around here, and I think this is one that we need to be real careful about.
I appreciate that, and
thank you, Rosanna.
The decision's yours.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, we'll recess until 5:30 in hearing room B.
Somebody take our stuff.
Yeah, get them.
And I've got my sign-up sheets. And let's call Stevie Remington and Dave Bedanke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stevie Remington, and I'm Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. And I am having distributed to you now a letter written January 17th after the first hearing and the immediate passage out of this bill of the House committee. I had testified that we were opposed to it and thought it would be unconstitutional under the Oregon Constitution. And it was passed out, but Mark Blackman, who I think most people understand is a very reputable criminal defense lawyer, submitted our testimony and cites particularly State v. Valdez, and I'm certainly not going to read the entire statement to you, but I want to point out two major points that he makes. One is the extreme importance of the fact that attempting to commit a crime, the substantial step toward the commission of crime, is very important in the analysis. There is no such crime under the federal statutes. So he believes and has stated to me that, in his opinion, the facts in the Terry case that passed federal constitutional muster that you've heard about this afternoon would also be a legal stop under the current statute. And I do want to read for the record this significant portion on the Valdez case, which is attached to the letter. This was overturned under the current statute, and what the policeman said was grounds for a stop. where the person's, quote, had on a real nice-looking blue leisure suit. The pants and the jacket were the same color and material. One had on shiny black shoes, had on a lighter blue shirt than what the rest of his leisure suit was. His hair was nicely done in an afro, real neat. He had a nicely trimmed mustache, looked real sharp, like other people, like a typical pusher to me. And that is what the court said was not enough evidence to constitute a stop, and suggest that needle scars on forearms may legitimately speak of possible criminal activity in drugs, but shine shoes, sharp clothes, neat afro haircuts, and people who stand and stare at officers and do not say very much, even in a setting where they're usually not found. One other point I want to make is to address the question of liability. There's no question in Portland that the single most frequent stop that is a stop and release because no evidence is found to further investigate, and they let them go and they are repeated, are indeed young black males. And I can tell you that time after time, they are told that they can't get an attorney, that no one is going to take a case that would go to a jury, that the amount of damages that would be awarded for a 5 or 3 minute stop would be so small that it wouldn't justify the attorney's time in bringing the case. Most of those illegal stops are for innocent people, not for guilty people, and they are released very quickly. And unless it is particularly egregious, as in this Oregonian case, they don't find attorneys, and police officers are not sued for that kind of a stop. And I think the abuse will be much greater, and that we have no need of this statute in order to make the stops that are justified under the Terry facts. With me is Dave Fedanke, Associate Director from the Eugene office, and he had a few additional things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. And I'm speaking also on behalf of our Lane County Chapter Board, which represents our approximately 700 members in Lane County, which unanimously passed a resolution opposing this proposed legislation. I have talked to numerous people over my 7 years' experience working with the ACLU who have complained about being stopped, they felt, without any cause, by police officers. And just to back up what Stevie has said, most of those people, whether they be people of color or others, do not pursue the issue when they have been stopped, and in fact they did nothing wrong and were not arrested. For the most part, they are concerned that if they were to complain to the police or to file a lawsuit, they would be subjected to further harassment. That is particularly true on the part of members of the minority community in the southern part of the state, who feel that they are already targets of police harassment under the current statute. And I don't think we can hammer home hard enough that how unfortunate it is that in the courts these issues tend to come up in the context of people who are guilty of crimes, and the issue is whether or not evidence is going to be suppressed in a criminal trial. I am convinced, based on my experience talking to people who have contacted our office, that there are far larger numbers of individuals, of innocent citizens, who have been stopped in violation of the current statute, who just feel helpless. And on the one hand, they count their lucky stars that they hadn't been doing anything wrong and weren't arrested. And on the other hand, they're outraged that they were stopped without reasonable suspicion and detained and had a records check run on them for no good cause. It is our position that the passage of this bill would make that situation much worse and would send the wrong message to our police personnel. In addition, the passage of this legislation would wipe away in one stroke all of the case law that has developed around this statute over the last 14 or 15 years, and would force most of those cases to be relitigated on the issue as to whether or not, number one, they are lawful under this statute, and number two, are they constitutional under the state constitution. Right now, we have a bright line, albeit one that's not working all that well, or as well as it should be, but we do at least have that case law out there, and we believe that case law is good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
How many complaints do you get?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, we don't keep a complete log. It would be impossible. We are very small staff, and usually there are four people on the phone all day with volunteers, and we quickly give out advice when there's this. For instance, this is not a case that we would consider taking unless we had egregious facts and a pattern in practice. And so our usual advice to that person would be, you need to see a private attorney, but unless there's substantial damage, it may be difficult to find someone to handle the case. But we don't keep a record of how many. And there are times of the year where they increase, summertime. We get a lot more requests, but it's not unusual to have 3 to 5 a week in Portland office. I don't know how you do it.
In the Eugene office, where we get about 5,000 inquiries a year on all topics, I would say we probably get 2 or 3 a week relating to police conduct, probably fewer than that relating to stops specifically. There was one example that might be illustrative to pass along to you. One of our members was with a friend who happens to be black. They were driving towards the mountains last spring in a car on Highway 58 and were pulled over by a state police trooper who readily admitted the reason he had pulled them over was because the black individual who was the passenger in the car was wearing a red bandana, and he wanted to be sure that he wasn't a gang member because they had gotten word from the state office to be tough on anyone that might be a member of a gang. The driver of the vehicle wrote a letter to us at my suggestion and also a letter to the governor's office complaining about that conduct. As far as I know, nothing was done to discipline that officer.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Is it? Clay Moline? I can't read whoever's right.
Madam Chair, Walter Todd from Salem Abbey, Chapin Millbank.
I think. It could be. Looks like Chap Mill something. Come on up, Walter. You got smart and printed. And.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walter Todd. I'm a private attorney in Salem. I spent 2 years with the Marion County District Attorney's Office and 6 years in private practice as a trial attorney. I'm a member of the OCDLA Board of Directors, and also the Oregon State Bar Indigent Defense Committee. Mr. Millbank was here earlier in the day, and due to some time constraints, he had to leave. He was here specifically for, I guess, some continuity. Ross Shepard testified earlier. This matter was examined by the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1973, and in fact, Mr. Millbank testified before the Judiciary Committee, and he was here again for the purpose of testifying against this bill, the same exact issue, and we went back and had his testimony copied, and I provided that to all the members. Beyond that continuity, I thought it would have been nice if he'd had that opportunity. I wanted to address the issue of the Legislative Fiscal Office fiscal impact assessment. I know it's an issue nobody's talked about this afternoon, but I don't understand how the office can determine that this would have no impact. That's one of the things that I agreed with Dale Penn about. As a matter of fact, his testimony earlier, nothing is litigated more often in the criminal system than the stop issue. It has been that way ever since 1973. That's another thing Mr. Millbank was going to indicate. He himself has filed and argued stop motions. He estimates
perhaps over 100 times. In the 8 years that I've been practicing, well, in the 6 years that I've been practicing as a defense attorney, I've filed and argued over 30 of them. I have researched, I had my law clerk research from 1973 through 1985, put together a summary of every stop case argued where there was an opinion issued by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. And during that time period, there were 67 opinions issued and written, and I don't have it for the last 4 years since 85. But I think that would be nice to have as well, because I'm sure the number is over 80 by now. But that represents to me a considerable expense in indigent defense costs alone, let alone the court time, the various district attorneys involved, etc. And I do agree with Mr. Fedanke that this is going to be an issue if this committee, legislature, were to pass the bill, that would have to be relitigated over and over again. And I give you, for example, the example that someone raised earlier this afternoon, I believe the police officer, about the individual walking in and out among the cars. I think that obviously is going to be litigated as to whether or not that person is about to commit a crime. And I think some people are going to differ from other people on that opinion, and some judges are going to...
What are you talking about? The only way that's going to be litigated is if the guy gets charged with a crime. And we're talking about a stop that occurs prior to an attempt. There's no crime that's been committed. The worst thing that's going to happen is no crime occurs. So the only time it's going to come up is if he gets caught in the act of the crime, in which case the statute wouldn't even have an effect. So what are you talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Grinsky, I'm talking about, sir, those opportunities that an officer has under this new bill to contact these people as a stop and then develop evidence of another crime, which would be the situations that we'd be looking at. People, for example, that had, let's say, stolen property on their person, and they agreed to talk to the officer, or the officer had the authority under this bill to stop them. Driving under the influence, people. Suppose the fellow had an odor of alcohol in his breath, and he admitted that he'd just driven to that location. I agree with you. The crime of attempting to break into those vehicles would have been stopped, just as it would have been stopped without this. The officer could have said, hey, you, what are you doing? That's a contact. The fellow could go, and we've solved that crime. But I'm talking about other crimes that arise, possession of drugs, etc., and those cases would be litigated. Whether that evidence that was found after that stop was admissible, that would be litigated, and that would go all the way up.
Are there other questions?
That's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to speak on House Bill 2250? Okay, let's move to 2251.
Any chance that we could... take a brief respite.
We could. the brief respite.
Kind of break up the momentum here a little bit.
Senator Grinsky is wishing to go into a work session here on
SB 25, or House Bill rather, 2588.
House Bill 2588. It is a hearing and possible work session.
Just as much as the next. What's that?
Senator Hill.
No.
Did you want to?
Okay. We'll work out that later.
Okay.
Go ahead, Lizzie.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2588 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky is moving House Bill 2588 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman? Waxman?
No.
Grinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker? Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, let's move. Oh, Catherine isn't. Is Catherine coming down?
You're calling.
Okay, good. Well, let's go on to House Bill 2251 now, and then we'll, when we get Catherine down, I don't want you to run away before we finish 2251, folks. I'd like to do a work session on 3195 before we lose our quorum. So... that's a Catherine bill, and that'll come after we do 2251. Okay, is Corey here? Or she gone? Oh, yes. Thank you, Corey, for waiting and being patient. We know you have lots better things to do, but
such a nice afternoon.
It's a nice evening.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm Corey Streisinger, representing Governor Goldschmidt, and I won't take much of your time. Other people are here to talk about the details of this bill. I'd like to express the governor's support. This is the bill that would allow joinder of multiple offenses in a single trial, and it's on the governor's priority list. I'd like to just mention briefly two reasons that the governor believes this is an important addition. The first being potential cost savings, and although those are always speculative, there is at least the potential that this bill will result in savings for the indigent defense system and potentially the court system and prosecution as well, simply because multiple offenses arising out of the same facts could be tried in one proceeding rather than in multiple proceedings, or rather multiple similar offenses. Secondly, enactment of a joinder law will, we believe, make for more accurate criminal histories, and that will enable us to identify serious offenders more accurately. And in these times of scarce correctional resources, much of our effort is geared toward devoting those scarce resources toward the offenders with the most serious criminal history. The current parole matrix takes criminal history into account. The proposed sentencing guidelines would as well. And under both of those systems, the number of prior convictions is an important indicator. Without a joinder law, however, the current practices do sometimes tend to underrepresent a high volume offender's criminal history. That is because if an individual, for example, supports a drug habit through repeated burglaries on a very regular basis, a district attorney may well choose to prosecute only one or two of those simply because it is unrealistic to hold 20 separate trials for 20 separate similar burglaries. Therefore, the individual does not appear to be a high-volume offender, although, in fact, he or she is. And by allowing those offenses to be combined in a single trial, we will have a more accurate picture of that individual, the risk that that individual poses to society. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Other questions? Thank you very
yes,
much.
Yes. What is this? Is this statute based on a federal statute or?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the bill I know has been before the legislature in substantially the same form many, many times, and I can't answer the question of where it comes from originally. I'm sure the district attorney representatives can.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Corey. Is it Sean? Is that how you pronounce it? And I need you to pronounce your last name.
I presume the last name is Four, H-O-A-R. And I realize Phil rather than
three. Unique name. I have several pieces of information for the members of the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Hoare, and I'm an assistant district attorney for Lane County. And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of House Bill number 2251. As you will notice, the information I've presented to you is a law review article that I wrote as a law student, and attached to it is a summary of a federal survey of laws of joinder in other jurisdictions. You'll note in my face, the face page to that attachment, that I refer to Senate Bill 461 repeatedly, and I apologize, I was had the misunderstanding that would be addressed, but as you well know, that's almost an identical bill to House Bill 2251. With the exception that the indictment or information has been substituted, or that phrase has been deleted from House Bill 2251, and the phrase accusatory instrument has been substituted for that phrase. I don't want to go into detail about all sorts of hypotheticals about what types of different types of joinders there may be under the new case law, unless you have questions, because it is so late in the day, but I'm certainly available for any questions. With respect to the different types of joinder, though, that this bill provides, Oregon law currently provides only for joinder of offenses that arise out of the same act or transaction. This bill provides not only for that, but also for related offense joinder and for similar character offense joinder. Senator Hill, you had addressed a question to the previous witness. This bill is based on Federal Rule 8A, and it's also, this bill itself is currently in place in the federal system and has been since 1853. It's also in place in the District of Columbia. With respect to
in this form,
yes.
Okay.
With respect to related offense joinder, it's currently in place in 42 other states as well as the federal system and the system in the District of Columbia. with respect to similar character offense joinder. It's currently in place in the federal system, 33 other states, as well as the District of Columbia. So with respect to the contents of the entire bill, it's currently in place in the vast majority of jurisdictions outside the state of Oregon. And I should also note that it is currently in place, the entirety of this bill, in all of Oregon's neighboring states. So what it does is not only brings us in line with current law in the federal system, but current law in our neighboring states as well, so that we're doing the same thing that our neighbors are doing. With respect to its advantages, I set forth in the Law Review article that I wrote, and actually as quoted by the American Bar Association's Task Force on Joinder and Severance, which is a combination of both prosecutors and defense members of the defense bar, this bill avoids duplication of evidence at separate trials. Under the Oregon Evidence Code, as well as Oregon case law, many of the offenses that might be admissible or that might be joined as related offenses or similar character offenses under this bill are currently admissible in trials of those separate offenses under the Oregon Evidence Code and Oregon case law. Therefore, without this bill, we're duplicating evidence on a daily basis throughout our Oregon criminal justice system. With this bill, we're going to avoid that duplication and bring and be able to litigate all those offenses that would likely be admissible at trial anyway. And so you're reducing the inconvenience to your victims, your witness, and you're decreasing the burden on your indigent defense resources as well as your judicial and prosecutorial resources. Again, the ABA Task Force on Joinder and Severance supports this and strongly encourages this bill. In fact, it's part of the federal system. This obviously minimizes the time required to dispose of the offenses, because rather than prosecuting 20 different cases of burglary, you may well be able to join them in one trial. It's probably not a realistic fact scenario to think that you're going to have 20 different offenses, because you're going to catch a couple of those before it gets that far. But you may well have several different forgeries, for instance, that relate to the same victim. But because they occur on different dates, under current Oregon law, they may not be joined. And you may have five or six different forgeries, maybe one-day trials at the very least, but nonetheless, there'll be single trials on separate days. Whereas under this bill, you have the same, those forgeries could be tried all in one trial because they're related offenses, the same victim, possibly the same teller at the same bank, possibly the same investigating police officers. They're also similar character offenses because they're all forgeries. With respect to the concerns that have been voiced by members of the defense bar, primarily...
Can I stop you a minute and talk about what's meant by character offenses, now that you've sort of alluded to that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Similar character offenses under the law are basically those offenses that are similar in type or nature. For instance, unlawful manufacturing of methamphetamine, an offense we see commonly in the state of Oregon. If you have somebody indicted for two different counts arising out of two different incidents or two different meth lab locations, that's a similar type of crime as the manufacturing of a controlled substance. And those two crimes are similar, of a similar enough character that they can be joined under this bill. Forgeries. You have several different forgeries, the same type of crime, and that would likely be joinable under this. It would be joinable under this bill. Is that...
That's helpful. My next question is, how wide are you going to be using somebody? What do you see the incidence of using this kind of a procedure?
Well, the cases, for instance, in my personal experience, I deal an awful lot with, your drug cases, a lot of property crimes, burglaries, and thefts. I see it as a help primarily, I think, in your property offenses. Your burglaries. We do have an awful lot of repeat offenders in the area because we'd have no place to put them, especially with respect to property crimes. And so they're back out on the street quickly committing more burglaries. And sometimes it would help greatly if we could prosecute several burglaries at one time. We usually have the same modus operandi. Sometimes you come up with stolen property when you make an arrest on somebody relating to different types of burglaries from different victims. And under this bill, all that evidence would be admissible at one trial. It'd be you join those burglaries. Under the current law, even though you may have overwhelming evidence that this person has committed these same burglaries, because you have stolen property from each burglary, maybe all these burglaries occurred in the same area, maybe this person even lives in the same area, has easy access to each of those homes, all those burglaries are separated. We cannot join them for trial, and you have six or seven or eight different trials. I don't know if I answered your question.
Isn't there some permissive joinder of criminal offenses at the present time? Certainly crimes arising out of the same incident can all be tried together, can't they?
Madam Chair and Senator Grinsky, I'm real glad you answered that question, because the appellate decisions in the state of Oregon have made permissive, pretty much rendered void any permissive joinder. The bill, as it was originally set forth, provided for some permissive joinder, yet the appellate decisions have restrictively construed that, so any time you're compelled to join is the only time you're allowed to permissively join.
You mean if the defense counsel says we'd be willing to try these things together, that's not acceptable anymore?
Well, if the defense counsel wanted to, but quite frankly, I have never seen a situation where that has arisen. If there's a stipulation...
I used to see it all the time.
Well, that would be great, but unfortunately, you don't see that too often. And of course, the consolidation is typically, it must be initiated by the prosecution. I doubt that you would have a defense attorney who might want a couple different types, a couple different cases of forgery tried the same time.
Attaches to about 45% of the charges that we have. It impacts those that they would be joined. I would agree this is a tool for the prosecution, and it may increase the numbers of pleas and reduce the trials. It is not an unfair advantage, however, because we have case law in the federal system for years and years and years, and case law in the other states that says this rule is fair when there is specific prejudice shown under these guidance, under these cases, then they may be severed. And that is the prejudice that allows severance. But that's basically what this bill does.
What about the charging piece?
Madam Chair, I'm very much against the proposed amendment because
What is the charging piece? Is the whole amendment. Let's talk about if you join for trial, then you join for charging.
Okay. Madam Chair, the reason I'm opposed to that, number one, there is no judicial gloss, and so we're in uncharted waters. We have nothing to guide us. Number two, I don't know what it means, something that I'm aware of or could be aware of. That will be an issue to deal with for years. But the big problem is that it requires me to file everything up front, whereas the whole idea, I get hammered in ways and means all the time about you file too much. And this bill, the amendments, would require me to file all, or else double jeopardy prevents me from ever going back with that. And I have the legislature and sentencing guidelines and everyone else telling me, we don't want you to file everything. We want you to file a few, not a lot. Joinder would allow us to file representative charges but keep those trials to a minimum. I think that's why the governor is supporting it, because it gives accuracy of records, but it does not increase indigent defense costs. The difficulty here is you have a philosophical debate. You'll have the prosecutors and you'll have the defense bar. And we will both say it has savings, fiscal savings, and the defense will say it will increase costs. And that's why legislative fiscal can't tell you what the impact of this is, because you have a philosophical debate. My one rhetorical question would be, if it is, as Mr. Henning says, will have really no impact, why do we have this philosophical debate? It is a prosecutorial tool. There's no question about it. It is an arrow in our quiver, and it is a law enforcement kind of approach, but I'm saying based upon federal case law, especially if you adopt legislative history, Ninth Circuit opinions. We know what this means. We know it's been considered fair, and it would pass judicial scrutiny.
I'm going to ask Jim, and then I'll let you go. I want to point to one of the cases where you went. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the 8th one down, where you charged for theft one, was not guilty by jury, came back and charged a robbery one.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd like Dale to talk a little bit about that, what
what this kind of thing, you know, because that's not, I guess I like prosecutorial tools, but I don't like them this way as much. And tell me how, whether this is going to make a change in that kind of charging.
I obviously, Madam Chair, I don't know the facts of this case, but I can give you an example that I have done this type of thing myself.
Do you do it often?
No, I do not, but obviously I can only speak for my office. I had a situation where I had two young women raped by an offender. They were Laotian ladies, and they had problems communicating in English. I had three charges of sodomy against this one individual. Two of them involved these two girls. I think under the federal rules, I could have joined this into one trial, but this is under present law. I could not join them. My evidence of my third sodomy was fairly unique in that while he was in jail awaiting trial on the sodomies against the young girl, he sodomized a young man who was in jail for a sex crime himself. Very difficult factual pattern to prove. My preference was to prosecute him on the other sodomies involved the young women. If I was successful on that, then I would not waste my resource or judicial resources to try to convict him of this other sodomy. I was unsuccessful on the first one. And so I brought the third case out, went to trial, convicted him of that case. But you have all kinds of prosecutorial decisions being made. I'm going to use my resources where I have the evidence. And if I can attach sufficient punishment to this individual, I don't need to bring out these other cases that may be weaker or may have difficulties in them and is maybe a 50-50 shot. And I would not be surprised if that situation is exactly what happened here, but that would be my response and where I've done that myself and where you get into a lot of different strategic decisions about what you're going to do and use of resources.
Thank you. Grinsky, don't go away. We're going to do one more work session. Okay, just
freelancing.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Yeah, let me ask whoever wants to respond. I don't know if you folks have much hands-on experience with the federal rule. I don't have any, but I'm trying to just conceptualize what it takes to prove specific prejudice. Presumably prejudice, the prejudice we're concerned about is in the mind, presumably, of the juror or some reasonable person out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you do it. It seems to me it's pretty tough to prove specific prejudice. But it seems kind of common sense to me that if you bring in an individual and they're looking at multiple charges, I mean, the jury's going to split the difference and say, oh, yeah, well, guilty of four, we'll throw out four. I'm not saying that necessarily happens, but we all know the kinds of stuff that goes on in jury rooms.
Certainly.
Anecdotally.
And, Madam Chair and Senator Springer, that is specifically what this little memorandum addresses and why I want to attach it as a document. I'll make other copies for Mr. Morris to supplement the record. But I guess the first answer to that is that we have the anomaly now that joinder law is so restrictive in Oregon, one of the most restrictive joinder rules in the United States, that there may be evidence code law that would allow you to prove these other crimes, to establish that this person committed this crime. Dayton Leroy Rogers is an example of that, where they went forward, that case is finished, but and watching in the newspapers, they proved all of these different murders because they were so identical and unique. Although they charge, they're only a few charges, but they're proving multiple murders to prove the guilt on these charged offenses. And yet you can't join those cases sometimes. You may prove multiple burglaries to show this person is the burglar, but you can't be joining these other burglaries without the consent of the defendant under present law. This law would allow us, if we're going to prove them, we can also join them. But specifically, the case law says severance is allowable when a defendant may be confounded or embarrassed in presenting separate defenses. In one of these burglaries, he's got an alibi defense. In another defense, he's got consent defense or something. Well, that would be a situation where the judge would say, that's specific prejudice, we're going to sever those out. The jury may conclude the defendant is guilty of one of the crimes charged and then find him guilty of the other because of his criminal disposition. And that is specifically the issue you're dealing with. And there is case law that deals with that, and that is one of the areas that the defense can come forward and say, I'm charged with these 20, and I think it's unfair because they're going to convict me all 20 when I'm really guilty of only one or two of them. But it becomes joinder first, and then we'll deal with the specific prejudice rather than the rule now that we'll do all 20, and only if there is consent will we bring them together in one trial.
But that's
what this addresses.
Okay, that's helpful, and if we don't have that, I'd appreciate taking a look at it. The ABA comment in the same Law Review article, in which I guess their task force raised some of the questions about the joinder issue, and seemed to come down on the side of current law in Oregon in terms of the concerns they addressed. Also raised as, I guess, a problem if a defendant decides to take the stand or feels that he or she can testify in one set of circumstances but can't in the other. And I'm kind of concerned at what point we reach a fairly lengthened motion and discussion just to get to the decision whether you're going to allow these to remain joined or severed, and just in terms of judicial economy and time, how much is going to get consumed in that process.
Certainly, and that is another basis, Senator Springer, to allow severance where you testify on one, not on the other. But remember, we're talking about 7% of the cases that go to trial. That's when the issue becomes important. Whereas now, it's mandatory for the district attorney in those cases that we can join to file motions to join those at the beginning of the case. That's the issue, and there may be litigated issues at trial, but we're talking only about 7% at the most.
And what I think he's making my case. What we're talking about are 0.7% of the cases when there was no reason for the district attorney not to have filed multiple charges. Those were the numbers where a defendant had more than one case charged in a three-county area. We're talking about three different district attorneys. So you're not talking about a large number of cases. Why create a complex problem? Why create the possibility that some of those cases, in any case, are going to have to be litigated and appealed? The simpler way is to say every incident is tried separately. And further, we don't turn the tables around 180 degrees and give all the power to the district attorney. What we do, we turn them so that we require that everything that we know, everything that can be charged against a defendant, be gathered in one place. That doesn't create extra court files. All it does, it means in one place we can go and we can find all the things against the defendant. And we can negotiate those, and most of them will go by way of negotiation. But what we have now is a mishmash where we have charges floating in from a number of different sources that we try to gather together. The court sometimes is successful, sometimes they're not successful. In this way, it would mandate not only that the district attorney look for those and gather them together, but that the court actually join them for the charging purposes, in our office, actually better than 80%, 83% of the cases.
Okay, I want to ask one very quick question with a response that's just brief from both of you. I asked us to get in on this with this kind of discussion. What impact would, if in fact we do move ahead with sentencing guidelines, what's that going to do to any of this? I mean, does that have an impact on whether we use the Hennings approach, the Dale Penn approach, or is it irrelevant? And if it's irrelevant, just say that and we'll be off and assume that I've asked an irrelevant question.
Senator Cohen, I don't think it's irrelevant. The Hennings amendment has so many problems because we get into issues of what does statute of limitations mean, what's speedy right to indictment, what's speedy trial rights. We just cut across all of these constitutional issues with this amendment, and we're into uncharted waters. I would rather kill this bill than to branch out with that amendment. I believe the reason the governor supports this bill is because it brings efficiency
in
procedures.
Okay, don't argue the bill. I just want a question about sentencing guidelines related
And the sentencing guidelines deal with single judicial proceedings as a concept in consecutive sentences, concurrent sentences, and sentencing in multiple jurisdictions. This encourages single judicial proceedings by allowing joinder of all these charges into one single judicial proceeding. So I think it is very consistent with and appropriate and a vehicle to assist sentencing guidelines because of that presumption they will be joined in a single judicial proceeding.
It doesn't mandate it, though, and that means you're going to have variance in different parts of the states where the district attorneys either bring everything together or don't bring everything together. And it means you're going to understate your criminal history in some cases.
Thank you very much. Any other questions before we go more?
Thank you.
Nice closing.
Thank you. Rosanna, I'd ask you for a minute. I don't think you can add very much to this. And I would ask you not to add very much to it because it would spoil our thoughts here to try to debate how we're going to do this. Okay.
Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. If these two gentlemen were doctors, I would ask for a third opinion. It's very confusing. I just wanted you folks to know that this bill is almost identical to Senate Bill 461 introduced on our behalf, and we had 52 co-sponsors, 16 senators, and 13 representatives, and we ask you to support House Bill 2251. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move to work session on House Bill 3195. That's the adverse possession, and we'll move to Catherine.
Are there amendments?
Yeah. There are amendments, but there are no debaters, we hope.
Let's hope.
The major debater has
I noticed
has
that.
Already
thanking many people.
No, he's fixed it.
What? Yeah, maybe we should pull him out for this.
Oh, there is someone there.
I believe you have another set already in your packet.
So there's two sets all together, the Weber Shoemaker amendments.
Oh, please.
It's okay. We're doing this for Larry Campbell, and it's so funny because I worked so hard.
Are we doing it for Everett Cutter, too?
Well, Everett has an interest, I think, yes.
He's been here for 6 hours, I hope he does.
Well, everybody's interested in all these esoteric items that we deal with in this committee. Okay.
Let us find
from the beginning. 3190, yes, you better start from the beginning, Catherine, because I don't believe.
I'm not sure we all know
that we it's pretty hard for us to find. This is the last bill, folks.
Right. And the number is 3195. It's the adverse possession bill. The bill itself codifies elements for adverse possession, and it changes case law by requiring the person entering the land or taking possession must do so in an honest belief that they were the owner. You also have to have that belief continue through the 10 years of possession, and you have to have an objective basis for the belief, and it has to have been a reasonable belief. It also adds that the elements must be proved by clear and convincing evidence. The second section, which is the enforcement section, talks about recovering possession, which is one of the remedies, and then allows for certain damages. The bill itself specifies that the damages, that the party is not liable for certain damages if they're occupied with an honest belief. And those in the bill currently are all damages done to property, basically all damages done to property during occupation, the value of the crops, trees, and the minerals, etc., that were removed, and the value of use of the land. The amendments changes this section, the dash two amendment, and we discussed this at the last hearing. It does two things. It changes a has to a have, which is just a grammatical correction. And then it also changes the damages. And it adds to the list of damages that you're not liable for, double or treble damages done under two statutes, which provide for treble damages for trespass and removal of certain items. And then if it's done by, quote, an innocent or less culpable trespasser, it would be double damages. Actually, what it's substituting that section for the more broad section, which would have been any damages done to the land. The result is that you've eliminated the ability to get the double or treble damages.
Okay.
Okay.
I want to say that this is fine. We really had full discussion on the Dash 2 amendments last work session, and I don't think anybody had a quarrel or question with them.
Okay.
What we need to do really now is to move to the June 7th. Quarrel or question.
Okay.
Maybe question.
And
but
these are Senator Shoemaker's amendments. Down on line 12, there is a reference to when.
Yes.
The damages apply or not. And it says, as a result of mistake as to location of boundaries. And the senator's opinion is that that is already included under sub A. And the same thing is true with 4 in that subsection. That the subsection A on line 9 takes care of B and 4, and that it complicates the bill by having the language in there.
Where is the azimuth is an honest mistake there? Where is that somewhere else?
It's sub A.
Which?
That'll be left in there.
You're going to leave A in.
Yeah, line 9 on page 2. There's several references. I think that's the one you're talking about.
The honest mistake will
be
left.
People who drafted it may have intended something else, do you think? Or did you talk to them?
I did not talk to the original drafters. I only talked to Senator Shoemaker about
Okay. Well, I would like to move the amendments and move the bill, and then we'll ask Catherine to check with the original drafters and see whether this meets with the Bar Association, because the Bar came in and testified. It was my understanding Senator Shoemaker was going to talk to, what's his name,
Mr. Grant,
to make sure, and we will double check. Oh, here it comes.
Yes, because I believe that.
I may briefly.
It does seem kind of confusing. The way it's originally drafted, but maybe there's something more there than we see.
Would you like to come and share your wisdom with us?
I would love to. Good evening. I'm David Kroll with Representative Larry
Not
Campbell.
Mr. Grant.
Not Mr. Grant, that's right. Talking with Mr. Grant this afternoon, and Mr. Grant and Senator Shoemaker have talked on the telephone, and Mr. Grant, as a representative of the Oregon State Bar Real Estate Land Use Section, did, if you will, sign off on the Shoemaker amendments.
Okay.
Great.
Madam Chair?
go ahead, Senator Grinsky.
Senator Grinsky.
I'd like to move the, I guess it's the Dash 2 amendments first.
Right.
May 30 of 89, and should we do them together?
Yes, please.
And the Weber Shoemaker Amendment of June 7, 1989 to House Bill 3195.
Okay. Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's amendments offered to House Bill 3195? Hearing none. So.
Yeah, what about that?
Oh, about this one.
Let's see what that. Oh, the Gabbert Cutter. The one that the railroads have been waiting for all this time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what that is, Catherine. What is that? Would you identify what you're holding in your hand?
It's Oregon Railroad Association, 620 Southwest 5th Avenue, proposed amendment to A. Engrossed House Bill.
Wait a minute, it looks like it's a compass.
No, I believe that's in the Dash 2 amendment.
It is? Okay. He's keeping his record clean. We're testifying.
We're okay.
It is in
I have notes that the Dash 2 amendments from Representative Campbell came over with a letter saying that they represent an agreement between the Oregon Railroad Association and the Bar and Representative Campbell's office.
Sure. Thank you. Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 3195 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky has moved House Bill 3195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brennan. Senator Brock.
Aye.
Senator Grinsky.
Aye.
Senator Hill.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker. Senator Springer. Chair Cohen.
Aye.
Move that Senator Shoemaker carry.
I've got it written down here ready. Did you answer, Senator Springer?
You didn't get to answer.
I don't think I got a chance to vote.
Well,
just spun
Springer off. Is recorded as
an aye vote.
Aye vote. Thank you very much. We are. Anything else tomorrow morning, bright and early, folks, 8 o'clock. But I do need to vote. Thank you.
You going tonight?